Yeah, I'm Jackson. I have zero experience with carpentry.
I studied at a school for historic preservation in Boston and learned about how things were built, you know, 250 years ago.
There's a long way to go. I'm nowhere near the top. Not that I thought I was, but there's so much more to do out there.
Welcome back to the Passion for Craft podcast. We are here on site at Whiskey Flats here at Brent's factory, if you want to call it that. What would you, the shop?
Shop.
Sweatshop,
right,
probably.
The sweatshop, yeah. right? Well, it isn't a sweatshop right now. We've got the these historic stoves here. Do you want to speak into these?
So, you know, for the cold months that we do have here, we have all this waste wood, and we wanted to burn it to heat the shop. We were having to bring in those torpedoes, buying a bunch of kerosene, buying a bunch of diesel to fire those things up to heat the shop. And we were like,
this would save
us a lot of time and money if we didn't have to do that. And so we bought these, and I bought, there's the guy in Boston, Dave Erickson Stoves, who I did a job, one of my jobs as a senior, it was my last year at North Bennett Street, was a doors, arch doors on his depot in Littleton, Mass, and he has a restoration company. And I've bought 7-8 stoves from him over the years. These are two of them. This is the 1880s. There's a big railroad depot, big barrel, pot belly. Thank you. Potbelly stove in there. It's huge. It's like this tall. And it was designed exactly for this. And so they heat great. I mean, it's only been on a few minutes and it's already thrown heat off. And so I think they're great ways to kind of remember who we are, what we do, and also function well.
Yeah, you get a little de-rester on this and you got a nice egg surface.
Cook some eggs.
Bacon in the morning. Yeah. Well, it's kind of fun because this is a big space, and you said it's going to heat the whole thing?
It'll heat this whole space, and we've got another one in there. So it'll probably heat, you know, if you think about a big railroad station, you know, 3,000 feet, 2,000 feet.
I mean, that's crazy.
That's plenty, yeah.
The point of this tour, one, was to tour the shop, right? And I kind of wanted to throw it out there that, you know, I think there's a lot of contractors who think, I ought to have my own cabinet shop, or I ought to have my own millwork shop. Talk about that. We also talk about kind of the growth of shops. You're going through this change where you're moving from a garage shop to, you know, something bigger, 2,000 feet. This is, you know, 23, 24,000 feet. And so, you know, what are those steps and what does it look like for guys? And we were talking about on the last one, you know, what tools do you buy, right? Mm-hmm. And so there are no edge banders here.
Oh, man. But I did see your CNC.
Yes, there is a CNC, yeah. So how do we balance that, being purists and stuff like that? So,
well, I'm coming from 400 square feet, so... Yeah, this is like Disneyland.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. You're going from 400 to 2,000. That's a 5 times, you know.
Yeah.
You know, 2,000 to 8,000 is, which was what our shop was at Lipscomb. You know, that's another 4 times. Then we went to this. That's another 3 times. And so, you're not just, you know, getting twice as big. You've got to get
incremental.
Yeah, you got to get, you know, multiple times bigger. Or doesn't make sense.
Well, at least I started in my own garage. You started in your brother's, right?
I couldn't afford a garage.
One step up.
Yes, I was in a 2-car garage in a 1920s house, and so.
So I mean, let's talk about that. I mean, just while we're here at the about to get going into this tour of this facility, what are the requirements that you think you need to size up? What are some of the symptoms of the problem where you're like, all right, I'm in my garage right now?
Oh, I can tell you that.
Oh yeah, yeah. Let's go.
You cut all your pieces and there's nowhere to assemble it. It's just like, all right.
What's taking the space? Is it the tools?
Or the tools. Because like a table saw, so, you know, like table saw right there. Yep. I mean, think of that in a 2-car. Like, there's one bay, you know, gone. So
yeah, because if you got an outfeed table, you know, you got the Biesemeyer fence on there, That is one car right here.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
And then the outfeed, that's the whole thing.
Right.
Thankfully, I have that combination unit that's table saw, joiner, planer, and shaper, which means I have a lot of changeover to do, which is why this is a dream to me to be here, because you just go from that machine to that machine, you know, they're all, and there's multiple of each machine.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the problem is you just run out of space, you know, there's no room to do anything.
For sure.
You got to move to the driveway. And then if it's raining, then what? Then you're, you know,
you're assembling tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So here's the thing. You've bought a multi-use machine. So instead of this table saw right here, right, you've got your machine breaks down and it's a shaper.
Shaper.
It's also a planer and a joiner, right? And so all in one.
All in one.
Okay. The problem with the all in one is you got to really think through all your steps because you join everything and then you get to, and then you
I'm
go, oh crap, I forgot to join this while your shaper's set up and you got to go break that down and just 30, 45 minutes changing things out, get it set back up to do one step, right? It's just, you're pulling your hair out.
Yes, it is. It'll drive you crazy.
It'll drive you crazy. So, you know, then you go, gosh, if I had a bigger shop, you know, to his point, then I could have those machines set up and I wouldn't be doing this again.
So to your point, what's your next size up? Like, what do you want out of the next shop?
I would want, it's 1,900 square feet, the ones I'm looking at.
Yeah.
And then some of it's like office use, but the majority of it is like this, like actual usable shop. I would want to invest in more machines so I could have multiple shapers set up, because when you're building these windows here, it's not like you're, all right, well, let's change to the tenon bit. Mm. You have a shaper dedicated to the bit or
So if he goes to that 2,000 square foot shop, then the next thing that happens is he's got one shaper, one joiner, one planer, right? One table saw, which is fine, right? But then you get three guys in there and you start bumping into each other, right? And then just on the shaper, let's say we're gonna build those window sash, you've got, you know, three different setups, right? And so are you gonna do all your setups? I mean, and setting up a shaper is hard because you gotta set your fence and you gotta set your knives, you gotta run test piece, you gotta make sure everything's fitting right, and then you run everything, right? Well, then if you break it down and you miss one, so the goal is that you have three of them set up, right?
Because you never move.
Yeah, never move. They're all set up. The fences are set up. The height of the blade is set up. Everything's perfect. And guys will put signs on the thing, do not touch.
Yeah.
I've already seen that walking around here.
Yeah, do not touch. This is set up, and it's just like, don't mess with this, because I just spent an hour setting it up.
Well, okay, so.
So then you got three shapers.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden he's going, I need a bigger shop, right?
And he was moving all those that had signs on them. I told him
not to. Yeah, I was messing with him. I thought it'd be a funny prank.
Yeah, hilarious.
Well, okay, so I think next step right here, Richard, you're looking into what machines to buy. Can we get an idea of like what machines you have right here in a, what is this, 25, is it what you said?
25,000.
25,000 square foot place. Do you want to start with the tour, old roommate?
I was making sure it wasn't my wife. Let's walk around and go check stuff out.
Nice.
Because, you know, basically the way we've got it set up is, and realize too, okay, so when we bought this shop, this was an empty warehouse, okay? The one tool in it was that CNC machine over there.
The Como?
The Como, way over there, okay? We've since bought a second Como, okay? But we bought, he had the original Como and he was a production cabinet shop. So realize how different cabinet shops are from mill shops. Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, he's talking about that, edge bander. That's what production cabinet shops have.
And we have a couple cabinetry guys in our Patreon who are cabinet makers.
Okay.
So I didn't know if like what is
well, my point is that it's just a different setup. Okay, so because
I'm saying what's the contrast between the two kind of, because obviously you bought the place, didn't you buy a couple of machines from the cabinetry setup as well?
We bought everything.
Okay,
we bought it as is.
So what it like? What have you been able to implement? Like what's the crossover?
Well, let me just finish this story.
Yeah.
So what he did was okay, and that rack there at the far end where you just see a few sheets of plywood. Okay, that was their plywood set up there, and one guy loaded the plywood onto that machine, cut out the parts, they put it on a little trolley, put it over here and set it down. went back over there. He was cutting another part, put it on a trolley, set it down. And then the guys would come in here and they would assemble the boxes, okay? And they'd put all the boxes together because that was cutting out the parts, and they would put the boxes together, and this room would fill up with cabinets, okay? We don't build like that. We build, you know, architectural millwork. So we're building doors and windows, and we are working on them on benches. They don't have any benches. So ours is kind of an old school way of doing it, maybe even not the most efficient way of doing it. But it's, you know, each guy has a chop saw. Each guy has his bench with his tools. Each guy has, you know, where he's cutting and fitting and making all his, you know, parts and pieces, right? And so we have used this space much different than he used it. So, but the things that we did buy from him, we'll show in the rough mill area, are, we lusted after, right? We looked at that stuff and like, oh my gosh, this is the, if we could have that, then we would be set. And so.
I know we'll see you later. What were those things?
Well, it's a gang rip, okay? Which is basically a rip saw is basically, you take rough lumber and it cuts a straight line. And that's, could be a whole conversation on precision, okay? Mm-hmm. Because basically if I cut, if I did a job site table saw, okay, which is a little DeWalt little thing that's probably, you know, 12 inches high, 12 inches wide, you know, 18 inches deep. Mm-hmm. Basically it's a table saw upside down on a fixed table. If I try to cut a straight line, okay, and what you're always doing in millwork is you're creating joinery, okay? So you're taking two, you know, historically a joiner, okay, was a guy who joined boards together, okay? And so we're trying to cut a straight line so that our boards can glue up together. Mm-hmm. But realize that if you don't have a perfectly straight line, that board, your glue joints to where the boards come together aren't going to glue because they're messed up. And so a job site table saw will not cut a glue ready joint.
Yeah.
Okay. A good table saw most likely will. Okay. But a rip saw, that's one of the requirements, is that it's a glue ready joint. Mm-hmm. Okay. So anyway, I'm getting into the weeds on this thing. A gang rip has multiple blades. So you can set up in production, you can take a 10-inch wide board and you need a 2-inch, a 2-inch, and a 3-inch board out of that thing. Whoa. You set it up, they have lasers coming down and show you where you set your board up, you run it through
so
there.
So you're cutting multiple pieces
at once.
So how many blades are on that?
Well, there can be up to 4. So you
can get 5 pieces off one?
Yeah.
Yeah, so to contrast with what I do to get a straight line, I'm only cutting one board at a time, and I'm using a track saw. I bought a big, it's called a TS-75 from Festool, and it's on a, you know, track of aluminum.
Yeah.
I lay it on a piece of lumber and then, you know, go across with the track, and the track keeps it straight.
Holds it on.
Yeah, and that's crazy when you think about it.
But what I'm really describing is speeding up every process.
Yeah.
So instead of him just cutting with his track saw, we're cutting 4 boards where, and all of a sudden you start counting hours, right? And so, you know, say he had a big window job and he had to cut all these things. It would take him, he's just pulling his hair out. And all of a sudden you set it into production shop and it's just, you know, in a tenth of the time, you've roughed out all the boards.
Before y'all had a gang rip, y'all were using a table saw multiple times over.
We had a so there's a straight line rip, okay, and then there's a gang rip, okay. And we were using a straight line rip, and then we got a gang rip, okay, which is just, it was a game changer. Oh my gosh, this is awesome, okay. And so joiners, planers, and wide belt sanders are back there.
Wow.
Okay, we've got a bandsaw back there, big bandsaw.
Well, cool. Okay, so that's helping me kind of get this picture of like the next level and like why this is Disneyland for you.
Yeah, it's all manual labor end. And
but I don't know if he ever wants to do production windows, right? Or production doors and things like that.
But it still is the man hours. It's still the time of the day.
I'm going to try to build those windows for my house, and that's probably about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That'll be, I'm trying to get this company to sponsor the windows. Mm-hmm. They're called 100 Year Window. They're just not working with me. Yeah.
Good luck. Good luck.
Well, cool. Let's start looking around.
Let's walk around. So One thing you'll notice,
you got soot on your neck.
I have soot all over myself from the fire.
So one thing you'll notice is that the chop saws at each station, right? You'll also notice a bunch of band saws around here. There's a big Tanowitz. There's a, you know, Inca. There's an old Delta, I think. And so you'll see little, there's a, obviously a table saw in here. So there's little versions of things that are happening in the big parts of the shop in other places, because guys will be building something and they'll need to rip something. So we've got a panel saw because we do build, but we inherited this. I don't know if we would have bought a panel saw just as because we do millwork shop, but we do use it, but this is more an adaptation. That was the Como we bought with the shop. And then 2 years ago, we bought this one, okay? Now, we're trying to make that step into being a production shop. And so this was a solution. The CNC was a solution for us because it's hard for us to find skilled craftsmen. It's hard for us to find people who know how to do stuff. So this was an effort for us to get joinery cut faster. You know, for window sills on our windows, it's really a great tool because it can cut out your dados for your jams and things like that. So there's a lot of advantages to that. We still haven't got the full use out of that saw yet.
This is like the AI tool.
Yeah. Well, it was met with a lot of skepticism. I remember when you first bought it, you were like, we don't really use the Como. We don't really, you know.
The problem is I'm kind of a purist. And so buying a CNC was a, you know, going to the dark side.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It isn't. It's a tool. But the stories that I had going into it was that people had fired their best people in order and bought the CNC. Because if you go to the trade shows and listen to the trade show men talk about this thing, one, they're fun to watch. And they set them up at these shows, and these guys are like carving Leonardo da Vinci heads. And you're just like, what? And it's like, this is incredible. This will change my business. And then you bring it home, and you're like, do.
Yeah.
Like, what's going on? Oh, why didn't that work? Technical support an hour later. Oh, hi. I'll have to transfer you. You know, it's just.
And you already fired all your guys. Yeah. You're like, dang it.
The shop's empty. It's like now. Oh, man.
I'm telling you, we're joking. But there's what happened to this great shop in Dallas. That's what they did. And they just went under. Okay. And so that was my fear. But in owning it now and had it for 2 years, the deal is that you got to get a good operator, and you've got to you just got to practice on it. The articles I read about it before we bought it was that you're going to buy it for one thing and you're going to end up using it for something else. And that's true. We bought it thinking that we would cut all our joinery, and we ended up using it for windowsills and different things like that. So
was it worth it?
We're using it not yet. Well, I shouldn't say that. The payback time wasn't as fast as we had predicted.
Okay.
But it certainly has paid for itself.
Okay.
But it's, you know, they predicted payback could be within less than a year, and it was not that fast for us.
Yeah.
But it does save us a bunch of time.
And that's probably what, like $100,000 or something?
higher?
Yeah, times three. They're $300,000, $350,000.
Wow.
Yeah, they're expensive.
You just crushed my dreams right there.
Good.
You were going to fire John.
It's good.
Yeah. This is some like evil scientist.
So, but in any case, why was I standing here?
Well, you were going to going through the tour.
Anyway, so panel saw we inherited, Como we inherited, this we bought. Obviously, we filled this up.
Let's couple go into band
the,
saws.
Let's go into the shape room.
This is probably the room we're going into, is probably your like most primitive room, right? Or is this, you know, like kind of old school shop?
Yes, this is definitely old school shop. Okay, so we've got
what do you mean by primitive?
Just like how they would have done it back in the early days.
OGs.
Yeah,
so we've got shapers in here, probably six or seven shapers in here. There's a hollow chisel mortiser. There's a tenoner, okay? So that Greenlee tenoner is probably from the 50s or 60s. That mortiser there is probably from the 50s. And so really old machines.
Which one's the mortiser?
Here, we'll go back and look at it.
Why is all your stuff old?
No. We're going to talk about this. So look at this, okay? See this? That's an entire cast iron base, okay? Yeah, break your toe. Look at this, entire cast iron base, okay? Look at those new Powermatics. Stamp steel, okay? So when you
and
go-
And those aren't even new Powermatics, no, you know?
So the newer machines you get, the less cast iron. You have these motors that are, you know, what are these, 70, 80 years old, and they just hum like a kitten.
German, right? Engineering.
They last forever. They're heavy. Because they're heavy, when you put a big piece of lumber on here, say you had a big long piece, it's not going to tip the thing over. Whereas
is that a concern?
Yes. When you take some of these big timbers and try to lay it on there and your machine starts going like this or your machine starts rocking, that's
scary.
A bad feeling, right? And so the these big heavy machines really, we think, are better, okay? Now, they aren't CNCs, they aren't, you know, computer controlled, although you can attach some of that stuff to them, but I am partial to the old machines. But talking, these are shaper room, okay? So we're talking about Richard and his deal, you know, that shaper setup. So this is like the window area.
Yeah.
And so then he's got tenoners, he's got, I don't even know what he's doing here.
Oh, don't adjust it.
Don't touch it.
He's got it set up.
I think that is a check. Yeah, it's the bottom of a thing. So we have a
wow. There's a knife.
We have a knife that. Set up for the bottom of our windowsill.
And that's where the two sashes meet.
No, that's a check rail. This is where the window meets the sill. Okay, and we have a little step in there that stops the water infiltration that we've had tested and we know. And so he's got a setup that all it does is cut that shape. So we want to leave this set up when we're making windows so that we can, you know, do that. Anyway, speed, it helps everything else, but that's what this room's dedicated to.
Yeah.
Is this where the majority of the 100-year window is made right here? Or is it the whole I guess it is the whole shop, right?
It's the whole shop. I mean, certainly
there.
A lot of pieces of it are done in here.
Like the joinery part
yeah,
of it.
Yeah. I mean, we've got two molders down there, so a lot of these pieces can run through the molder and stuff like that, but when you're getting into that fine construction, it helps to do this. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's a curved sash from Thistle Hill. And what's interesting is that, you know, should we even talk about this? Because this is totally off topic, but it's cool. So
I think we should talk about it.
So
it's in the shop.
One thing that's awesome is that this is a curved sash. Okay, so these goes in the rotunda at Thistle Hill, and so one, the glass is curved. How do they do curved glass?
On a form.
Yeah, like they set it on the.
So yeah, so they pull the cylinder glass while it's still warm. Okay, they create a form. So when you order curved glass, you got to give them your radius. They build a radius of form and they lay the hot glass over top of that radius, let it cool, and that's how you get this curved glass, right, to that radius. Notice that they've got a wood stop in here. It's not a putty stop. Now you don't get that very often, but
isn't the putty like the expected, what is it called? The
sacrificial
material.
Yes, and so that's why this is surprising that they would, that they had wood. The fact that it's lasted this long.
Yeah.
It's hard to get wood to last this long.
Yeah.
And, you know, we find wood glazing stop in 5%, 2% of the windows that we work on.
Really?
Okay. They're just rare, and we like to copy it and match it when we are, so we're doing that. These pieces are straight, these pieces are curved,
yeah.
So you actually have to cut this form out and then you have to shape it, cut this form out and then you have to shape it. So that's how you're making those curved sash, but it's pretty awesome.
You said you will restore it back with wood, not with, okay, yeah. Just because it's original?
Yeah, exactly.
But so, you would prefer putty?
I know that putty lasts a long time, okay? Mm-hmm. I know that it works. This is, you know, 115 years old. So, you know, like, well, you can't, it lasts a long time.
Yeah, can't argue with that.
With putty, how often are you replacing the putty?
Every 50 years. if it's done right.
That's awesome.
But and I mean, there's putty that's 150 years old that hasn't been
touched.
Yeah, so it's just, you know, why is that? I don't know. You know, the amount of exposure, west versus south, you know, anyway, mm-hmm. you know, versus north, you know, just who knows what those conditions were.
To the question of, like, the Theseus's ship, you know, do you know that it's the Greek thing where they're talking about the guy who goes on the ship, who goes on the journey, and over the journey, his boat keeps getting replaced with new and new parts, and then at the end of the journey, he's got a brand new, he's got the same ship, but it's all the parts are replaced. You know what I'm saying?
What's it called?
I think it's Theseus's ship, I think. Could be wrong. But what amount of this window are you replacing? Like, other than the glass, I'm sure the glass is staying. But, like, will the whole window be brand new wood? Are you restoring the wood? Or, like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, this sash appears to be in really good shape. So I don't think we'll, I mean, what.
Has chips Abitronic. And nicks all over
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we've got nicks and chips on it, but I mean, 2%.
Totally good.
You're not fully replacing it.
There's nothing wrong with that. Right. And even if you look at Thistlehill as a whole, 2%, 3%.
Yeah.
Like, we've got a few rotten bottom sash. We've got some mutton bars that need to be replaced. But for the most part, we're, you know, reusing the whole thing.
That's crazy.
Which
That's
awesome. Speaks to the incredible quality of the wood, right? And the reason that stop has stayed there is because it's old growth wood. I think it's old growth oak too. So,
yeah. I was wondering how much of, like, the old growth versus new growth plays a factor into that. It has to play everything.
It's everything. It's 98% of the reason why it's successful.
Yeah. What do you think about old growth compared to Sapele, what you're using now? I mean, yeah, I don't know if
in the 100-year window specifically.
Yeah, just for exterior use, like, I guess the question is, like, what's better? But you don't have enough research on the Sapele, or
so. I put the woods in the categories. I would say that you've got woods that perform really well, woods that perform okay, and then woods that don't perform. And it's in the category of woods that perform really well. Now, which one's better? I don't know. There's, you know, the best wood that I've ever seen on an historic window was a church we did in Dallas that was all redwood. It was old growth redwood, and that wood looked perfect. It looked like, and it stood up against masonry, like it was, meaning that it would have sucked the moisture out of the masonry and rotted out really quick, and it didn't. It was the finest I'd ever seen. So old growth redwood, I would say,
wins,
right, that thing, but.
It's also a 100-year time investment to get your wood out of that.
Sapele, we know, is a good performing wood. Is it better than old growth wood? I don't know.
You just don't know. Yeah, yet, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
It's too soon.
Yeah.
Yeah. We haven't been doing it long enough to.
Yeah, I mean, all those, all these woods should last 100 years, right? Mm-hmm. At least, in poor conditions, right? And survive despite neglect. Okay. Those middle performing woods that are okay, they would fail. And those other woods, they'll fail no matter whether you do everything right. Yeah. They're going to fail. Yeah. So
That would be your balsas and
poplar, the western pines. Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
Another part of the shop.
So what is this?
So now you're looking at a restoration of a sash from the carriage house. It's a casement sash. We know that because there's the hinge marks there.
Easy there.
Right, the mortises. But this is a lot of work.
looks like a lot of work.
Well, imagine cutting every one of those individual things, tacking them in place.
Are these mortised into those?
They're not.
They're just tacked in.
They're just tacked in.
Is that normally, historically, how you would do it?
In Texas, okay, I find in the Northeast that most of these things are mortised together. And down in the South, they just weren't. And mm-hmm. and I don't know whether that was a, you know, cheap Southern labor or what the deal was, but that's, you know, that's how we find it. And so that's how most of our windows were made.
It's lasted this long, right?
So. Yeah, I mean, and so I don't think there's a longevity issue. Essentially what happens is that once the glass gets in here, sets inside here, is locking it all together. And so, but the thing that's a lot of work, the most amount of work, is the glazing of this thing.
I was gonna say.
I mean, because you can't go. You're going.
When you do your glazing contest, are y'all using these?
Probably not. Yeah.
What do you really think you can beat everyone here? Why do you have that much confidence? Because they're making these day in and day out.
Because I watched them do it, and they're doing it so slow.
Have you done it in a while?
When I did my window restoration videos.
Right, yeah, fair enough.
So it's just they're, yeah, I 100%. I'm going to smoke them.
Confidence.
I can't wait to watch that video. Y'all better make that a video because that'll be
fun.
If you're
that
watch.
Confident, then do this one and they can do a normal sesh. Just like.
I doubt.
No. Well, I can't
that's,
do that.
No, that's that is hard.
I was going to say, what? 1, 2, 3. That's a 6 times effort, right?
I mean, this probably would take someone, you know, 2 hours to glaze this window.
2 hours. That's still fast.
Someone, that's fast?
That's, and versus a open light sash take, you know, 6 minutes.
Right.
My one that I did, I've never done it, never had any experience when I did mine. It took me like 2 hours to do one.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know what I was doing. Just like reinventing the wheel. There's not a lot of content on it.
There's not a lot of glazing video.
Yeah.
How to glaze a window.
Not at the time I was doing it, at least. Yeah.
Good video.
It's hard.
Ideas.
I guess that's what I'm saying. Like, it's harder than it looks.
All right. So let's go to the rough mill area, okay,
right
where
on.
All the big machines are, and we'll talk about that.
Gang rip, planer, joiner, sanders,
pot belly. Got a light
which
the
we
stove.
Don't have the pot belly going.
So straight line rip, which is basically a table saw, powerful table saw.
What are these things?
These are, this is anti-kickback, so if it goes through there, it won't kick back. These are tracks that hold the wood and run it through, keep it very straight, very. So once you set this fence up and run it through there, it'll cut the same exact thing over and over. And that thing runs really fast. So it goes, I mean, like, zoom, zoom, zoom.
Really?
It'll cut really fast. Oh. So this is a big planer. And you're always wanting, like, bigger planer. This is 24-inch. There's 30-inch planers. But you don't have boards that are 30 inches wide. So it's not like you need that much. But you need, I remember I had a, 12 is about the smallest they get. I had a 16 inch and I always wanted a 20 inch. And then you always want the bigger tool.
I'm there right now. I got a 12 inch.
Yeah.
I want like a 24 now.
Yeah. So here's a joiner. Joiners is when you're making millwork.
This thing is a beast.
This is where you start. I love this. This is a Newman.
That is
Newman. oh, wow.
I don't know if this is.
Look at that thing purr.
I need my mic close.
So stable, so strong, so. But this is where you start. So you get a rough piece of lumber.
That way.
Rough piece of lumber. You run it through here, and you are basically squaring one face, okay? And then once you get a square face, you run it up on its edge, okay? And this has to be 90 degrees, and then you've got your square edge. Because what you're trying to do is start
squaring up a board,
right?
Yeah.
And so once you've got your square edge, then you can take to the planer, square the back side. Now you've got three sides that are square to each other.
Why can't you flip it and do it again? Why can't you just do all of them on one?
Because if the board is like this, you're just going to be smoothing this thing and smoothing this face, and you've got to get it like this.
Yeah.
And so the planer, you know, once you get this 90 thing, the planer will make this one's completely square.
Square to the 90.
And then you take it to a table saw or a straight line rip and you get
got
your
it.
Finished piece that you can take to a shaper and start running all the other pieces.
They've really thought this through.
If you use that straight line rip, you don't really need to run it across this, do you? Because you can, if that's giving you a glue joint, you know, you wouldn't need to get it here again. You could just go from there to the planer.
Is that true? No, because if again, if your board's cockeyed.
I'm only talking about the edge, I guess. The edge. Like if
I know. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, you would still need to come here for the face.
You still have to square the face to the edge.
Yes.
So you could start there
and then come here with that
come
edge
here.
And then go face.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. The These are wide belt sanders. We've got two.
So their job is to sand the front and back of the thing?
Yeah. So, you know, most of the shop's filled up with Thistle Hill windows right now, as you can see. They're everywhere. But typically we'll have rough lumber here. You can see a little bit of it in that stack, and that we're running rough lumber through here, but we're not doing that right now. We're working on these windows, the main thing in the shop. So, but this is the rough mill area. So what's this? Probably another 3,000, 4,000 feet.
Yeah.
Set up like that.
Is that the molding knife maker?
No, that's a CNC lathe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
Wow.
He never used it, and we rarely use it.
Mm. Not a good, that's like, that's like an edge bander then.
He bought it because he was going to turn do a lot of turnings, and then he didn't end up doing any turnings. It was cheaper for him to buy it out, and he never ended up using it. And so he said, I remember him walking me through the thing. I never used that thing. And we go, we'll use that. We just don't use it that much.
Would y'all use it for stairwells, or like what would be the?
Well, the problem is that, yes, you could.
Yeah.
Okay. We've done it for turn balusters on a porch.
Yeah.
We made some custom ones. We did a bunch like that. But we just don't get into production stair parts, right? We're a window and door company, and so
makes sense.
We're getting.
So could
away from
you use
that.
It as a normal lathe without the CNC feature? Just that's a lathe over there.
Uh huh. But we've got a hand lathe over there that we use more often.
Okay.
So relating this to a new shop, right? Almost maybe this tool is the only one that would go into a shop your size, mm-hmm. right? And so all these other ones are for later shops. Now, if you're only a cabinet shop, you might have a CNC. I know some cabinet shops that that's their first tool. Mm-hmm. Table saw, because a lot of those early cabinet shops are buying doors. They're not making doors. Hmm. They'll make the boxes, then buy the doors because they can get they can buy the drawers. They can buy dovetail drawers. You give them all your sizes and they'll ship them to you.
They can buy it cheaper than they can
make them. So you're buying out all these parts. So depending on what kind of thing you're setting up, how you're setting up. Now, my whole deal and what I kind of hope for Richard is that you end up being that custom mill shop that can make custom cool things that aren't off the shelf. Because mm-hmm. most cabinet shops, in my opinion, are making off the shelf type things. Mm-hmm. And so I look at all the production shops that we do window for, they all do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so they're a commodity to me. They're not I got to get them to do our job. Whereas mm-hmm. I listen to my project managers talking about you and your team going, I need to get Richard on our jobs, right? They're not going, they don't say,
look at that.
We need a trim carpenter. We need Richard, right? And that's what you want. You don't want, well, we need production cabinets. And so there's five production cabinet shops that do work for us. For upstairs vanities and things like that people don't want to spend a bunch of money on, and so they're all the same. Mm-hmm. And my hope for you would be that you would be someone who would be doing those custom things. We got a weird stair that needs to be built. Can you help us out? We've got this paneled wall that and so
I mean that is your vision is my exact vision. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like that little brass detail we did.
Yeah,
like that was a crazy thing to figure out and do.
So this is the original two-car garage, we think, that was his shop,
So back in my territory.
Yeah, exactly. So he really, the way he grew is he did this and then added on, right? And so that's why we have the collections of different shops, because he just kept adding square footage. And so, here you are, Richard.
Yeah.
Why don't you do that?
He had more land to grow into than you've got. So, and now it's just a collection of different things from the shop that we've used, including knives and everything else. But as we go down there, there's the gang rip, it's on the right, some more shapers down here, and then we go into the molder room. You're basically cutting your own knives. This is a grinder to cut knives. And so, all the knives that you'll see in that other room and all these molder heads basically are set in a molder head. So the molder head's right behind you. We'll set them in here, and then this wheel right here will cut the template. You see the template, the plastic template right there? And so that is moved around, and it cuts basically your knife in so you have two knives.
There's a template.
Two knives in the head, yep. And you have two, that'll go over there. It's basically a big key machine. So yeah. Whatever template is over there, it'll cut that shape into the knife on the molder head. The advantage of cutting the knife in the molder head is that you can then pick up the molder head, go shove it on your machine, tighten it up, and you're ready to go. Remember the setup we were talking about with the shaper, moving the fence, adjusting mm-hmm. the knives, all that stuff? That this is the thing that really speeds it up, makes it go a lot faster.
Is that steel right there?
Yeah.
So from a solid block of steel, and you in the time you begin, how long does it take to get a shape out of it?
You can probably cut, if it's not too complicated, in 20, 30 minutes.
So it's quick.
Pretty quick. Wow.
And you need to do three of them, right? For a
two.
Two for a molder head?
Yeah.
Okay.
Two knives in a molder head. So, yeah.
Wow.
And then we can go stand out there now. So here's an example of a bunch of the knives that we've made, profiles that we've copied and everything else. All of these that were done with custom knives, put on a molder. Now we've got two molders here, and he had these outfeed tables so that one person could feed a molder. And talking about getting into production, if you've ever planed wood on a planer, you have to have one person feeding it, one person catching, right? And so that's a waste of two people, yeah. Two man hours just holding and catching wood. He put these return trays in it. So what happens is one person can load this thing up, it goes in there, feeds on here, and then shoots back so that this one person can load, it goes through there, picks it up, he grabs it, puts the finished thing on a deal. So
it's a baggage claim.
It's a baggage claim, right? And so it's kind of an interesting way of him saying, well, look, I might spend, 80 grand or on this return thing, but it'll pay for itself in a year.
Yeah.
Because I don't have to pay two people to do it, yeah. Right, all the time, or whatever the numbers are.
And the other guy can do something like more productive,
Yeah, it's totally.
The other guy can be on that one.
Yeah.
So.
Twice the work.
Anyway, hopefully you're seeing, right, in this thing, these levels of production that are going on, and this level of thinking about how to get faster, how to get better, how to get more efficient, right, as the shop grows and as you really start thinking about man hours and really start managing the numbers. It's difficult to still manage craft when you're trying to be efficient, mm-hmm. because you're always looking for corners you can cut and things you can do. And when are those decisions that are actually gonna cost you the craft and everything else? And so balancing all that as you grow, I think is a real challenge.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say, are you still thinking of changing the layout? I know we talked about that on an episode, reorganize.
I think what we're going to do, because we're still in that quest of becoming a production shop, right? Not a job shop. And so we've looked at other shops. We've looked at other places. We've talked to a number of people. I think what we're going to do now is build a big shop over top of those two shops in the back, build a big facility, then tear those walls down and move everything around. So we will be moving things around. Because we're doing window restoration and new window production, we're considering that we'd have two halves of the shop, window restoration side and production side. We're still trying to figure all that out. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't been mapped out yet. Our steps are this next year that we're going to do a certain volume again of windows and doors, get really efficient at it. And then if we can see that we're making steps, then we start mapping out, because we're still probably 2 years, 3 years away from doing that big shop change.
Yeah.
But because this is, we're looking at this shop going, how much can we get out of it? We did 2 million, 3 million. We're going to do over 4 million this year. Can we do 5 next year? Can we do 6? Can we do 8? Right? What can we do in this space without changing it? And then change it as a last resort.
Yeah.
It's a good problem that we need to change.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
I don't remember. I don't remember. Completely lost it. I was thinking about what that noise was. Well, cool.
Yeah. All right. So if you guys are out there trying to think, hopefully this has helped you kind of get your head around growing, maybe what kind of shop you need, what kind of tools you need. If you have questions or anything, put them in the comments. We'd love to hear them. But I hopefully, as Richard grows, as we're growing, as you see these two different sizes, maybe you're in your garage right now, this will help you think about how to get better and what your next steps are.
Thanks for watching this episode of Passion for Craft.